Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Barry Eichengreen, who is the Pardee Professor of Political Science and Economics at UC Berkeley. His new book is Exorbitant Privilege, The Rise and Fall of the Dollar and the Future of the International Monetary System. Barry, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Harry.
Let's talk about reserve currencies. What is a reserve currency and what is its function?
Well, a reserve currency is a national currency, first and foremost at the moment, the U.S. dollar, that is widely held by foreign central banks and governments. Why do they hold it? They hold it as a form of insurance. If something goes wrong in global financial markets, it helps to have dollars. They hold it because foreign currency reserves are useful for managing the exchange rate for intervention in the foreign exchange market. And sometimes, as in the case of China, they hold it as a byproduct of other policies. China wants to keep its own currency down, so it buys dollars as a way of achieving that.
And what are the characteristics of a reserve currency that make other countries want to have it?
Well, stability. Number one, there has to be confidence that the value of that currency is secure. Liquidity would be number two. It has to be easy to utilize that currency, buy and sell it without moving prices. And the fact that lots of other governments and private market participants use that currency for their international transactions as well. So a reserve currency has to be widely accepted.
And you call your book Exorbitant Privilege. And where did you get that title?
I didn't get it, but it has been widely utilized recently to refer to the fact that the dollar plays this distinctive role in the international system. It's not only America's currency, but the world's. It is widely used internationally. The phrase is associated with French President Charles de Gaulle, who was a critic of this asymmetric role of the dollar and more generally a critic of the United States. In the 1960s, my Berkeley colleague, Pierre-Olivier Gourinchat, has taught me that the phrase actually originates with de Gaulle's finance minister, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing.
And so the idea is, and we'll talk about the exorbitant privilege, but when we're looking at a reserve currency, there is, I guess it, one could say there's responsibility that goes with that, and also privilege. So let's talk about the responsibility. If you're going to be a country that is the reserve currency, what is expected of you?
Well, you have to be a faithful steward of that currency. If you begin to inflate away its value, if the dollar, to take the example du jour, loses value on foreign exchange markets, foreign holders begin to get antsy with good reason. So your duty is first and foremost to be a good steward of the currency. In addition, the fact that the dollar is the world's currency makes the Fed not only the central bank or the lender of last resort for the United States, but a global lender of last resort as well. So we saw after the failure of Lehman Brothers that global financial markets seized up and governments, central banks, corporations were scrambling madly for liquidity, for dollar liquidity, because they needed dollars in order to export and import. The Fed extended four $30 billion credit lines to a quartet of foreign central banks as a way of reliquefying markets. So in the same way we expect our central bank in the United States to provide emergency liquidity here in difficult times, the central bank whose currency is used globally has to think and act like a global lender of last resort at times as well.
And I think recently the Financial Times indicated that I think it was close to 50% of the TARP money went to foreign banks. Did I see that, or is that too high a number?
Well, that I think that is a separate sort of operation. But the fact of the matter is that commercial banks around the world do a lot of their business in dollars. They take, in some cases, deposits in dollars. They extend loans in dollars. When they get into financial trouble, they need dollar liquidity. And that can be provided only by the United States, whether by the Treasury through the TARP or, more commonly, the Federal Reserve through swap lines and credits.
Looking at who can be the reserve currency, one has the sense, after reading your book, that the people who are managing the reserve currency have to, a sense, have an interest and a concern for the whole global financial system or the whole global economic system, in addition to their concerns about whatever country we're talking about, in this case, the United States. So that would that's an interesting dilemma, and I guess only certain countries can hold that duality in place.
There's a famous analysis of the Great Depression of the 1930s by the late, great MIT economic historian Charles Kindleberger. He saw the 1920s and 30s as kind of a tipping point away from the 19th century world, where sterling had been the leading international currency, toward the 20th century world, where it became the dollar. He explained the Great Depression as a product of the inability of a declining Britain to stabilize the international system and the unreadiness of the rising power of the United States to do so. The U.S. hadn't gotten its mind around yet its new global responsibilities. So if you buy that as an interpretation of the 1930s, and to an extent I do, it makes you worry about our present juncture, where we may be seeing another changing of the guard, slowly but surely, away from the dollar toward some of its new rivals.
And we are seeing that as a result of the 2008 collapse. Before we talk about that, I want to focus on a very important aspect of your book, because in today's world, everybody's saying, oh, it's over for the dollar. And what your book, the beauty of your book, is to show us how complex a process it is to become the reserve currency. So let's talk about that, because it's not the case that an emerging power can say, hey, I will undertake this task. It's a very complicated process. You point out the dollar had, by 1870, the U.S. had pulled ahead of Britain in the production of goods and services. By 1912, it had pulled ahead as an exporter of merchandise. But its global financial role took longer to occur. So let's set the stage. The dominant power has been Britain. The reserve currency is sterling. There's a new challenger on the block, the United States. those years point to when it was overtaking Britain, but it takes a while for its role to be realized. Why?
It takes a while because you've got to put a series of institutional prerequisites in place before a national currency can really play an international role. But at the same time, it doesn't take forever. So one of the points I make in the book is conventional wisdom has it that the dollar really only overtook sterling as the dominant international currency after World War II. But conventional wisdom is wrong. And in fact, this transition occurred over a period of about 10 years from 1914, when the Fed was created, to the middle of the 1920s. What you need for your currency to play an international role is a big domestic platform. And the U.S., as you said, already had that by the late 19th century. We were a bigger economy, and by the early 20th century, a bigger trader than Britain. We needed deep and stable financial markets. We didn't have that. We had a series of financial crises in the late 19th century, again in 1907. We needed a lender of last resort to provide emergency liquidity to the markets, and we needed a sound regulatory framework. So what happened was that people began to realize that influential politicians like Nelson Aldrich and private market participants like Paul Warburg came together. One of the reasons the Fed was founded in 1914 was to stabilize domestic markets, but also internationalize the dollar. So the Fed was created. We had a central bank to backstop the market and provide international liquidity. And the Fed quite aggressively over the succeeding 10 years tried to create a market in securitized trade credits to make the dollar attractive to private international users, importers and exporters. And that in turn made it attractive to foreign central banks. So my message there is you can't rely simply on the miracle of the market. Having a big economy helps, but you need a policy initiative to make it happen. If you have that, the transition can occur quite quickly. We did it between 1914 and 1924. I'm not predicting that Chinese will do it between 2011 and 2021, but they could.
Mm-hmm. And let's characterize for me the people that you just mentioned. There's Aldrich, there's Warburg, there's Strong. What was it about this group of men who over time built these institutions and got laws passed and so on? Was it about their concern about international finance, or was that just a byproduct of stabilizing the American economy, which required something like the Federal Reserve?
Well, here I would agree with the work of scholars like Lawrence Braz at the University of California, San Diego, who have shown, I think, pretty convincingly that the founding of the Fed reflected a confluence of factors. There was concern about domestic financial instability, but there was also concern about the fact that the dollar played no international role, and that when U.S. importers and exporters needed credit to finance their goods, they had to approach their domestic bank, which had to approach a correspondent in London. The trade credit was in sterling. The U.S. importer and exporter paid two commissions, bore the exchange risk if sterling fluctuated against the dollar. The international dimension was important. Warburg, influential financier, had grown up in Europe. He'd been involved in the export-import side as well as financial business. So I think it was this meeting of minds, but also meeting of different imperatives, the need for a new institutional framework to stabilize American financial markets, and at the same time, the desire to internationalize the dollar and challenge sterling.
And let's look, take an example of a kind of a nuts and bolts issue that you talk about, namely, before the Fed instituted new rules, American banks couldn't have branches abroad, which then was a missing piece in this puzzle to create an international credit market.
Right. So a number of things changed to bring the dollar to international prominence between 1914 and 1924 to make it attractive for use by importers, exporters, bond issuers, central banks alike. One factor was you had a market maker, the Fed. Another factor was that the Federal Reserve Act allowed U.S. banks to branch abroad for the first time, which they did quite aggressively after 1914. Another factor, of course, was World War I, which disrupted the provision of trade credit by London. As sterling began to fluctuate, its exchange rate began to move against the dollar. Getting trade credit in sterling became riskier for U.S. Importers and exporters. So all those things, I think, came together to get us to the point where the dollar was more important than sterling in 1924 as a reserve currency, as a currency in which to denominate foreign bond issues, and as a source of trade finance as well. It had played zero role in any of these domains 10 years before, so its rise was quite dramatic.
And yet the tottering sterling didn't really fall over. And you attribute that to a phenomena that may be present today, namely kind of the inertial quality of being the incumbent reserve currency. Talk a little about that. Why is it so hard to push, you know, the old system aside?
Well, incumbency is an advantage in politics. And it's an advantage in maintaining international currency status over time as well. If lots of other people are accustomed to pricing their imports and exports in pound sterling, it kind of makes sense for you to do the same so that customers can compare prices more easily. If markets are used to foreign bonds that are that pay interest in pound sterling, and you're a new issuer, a government coming newly to the market, it makes sense for you to denominate your bond issue in sterling as well. So I think there are a variety of reasons. Economists refer to all these effects as network externalities. If other people in your network are doing something, it pays you to do likewise. So, as I said before, the U.S. had overtaken Britain in economic size already in the 1870s, and sterling does hang on as a full-fledged rival to the dollar right up through World War II.
I should mention at this point that people should look at your book because it's very fascinating how these stories of institution building sort of inform our understanding of today when we're trying to figure out who's falling and who's rising with regard to the international monetary system. So the moment comes for the U.S. really after World War II. Talk a little about how it all comes together after that war and all the characteristics that you previously identified. Stability, liquidity are there, and there's really no challenger.
Well, I was going to say all the prerequisites for dollar dominance are there after World War II. The U.S. is far and away the largest economy in the world. We can leave aside the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc for present purposes. They were largely cut off from the West economically and certainly financially after World War II. The U.S. has far and away the most liquid financial markets. only the U.S. allows free access to its financial markets to investors, private and official, from other countries. And the U.S. economy is stable financially and economically. But the other important part of the equation is that there are no rivals, that the European economies are only slowly, in the second half of the 1940s and in the 1950s, regaining their feet. Japan, the emerging market, is not yet on the scene. Britain is the sick man of Europe. So it's really the, as I said, the period of dollar dominance. People generalize from the third quarter of the 20th century, when the dominant, when the dollar was the one and only international currency, to other periods. I think that third quarter of the 20th century was exceptional in this regard.
Mm-hmm. And it you make the point again and again in the book that this is really about having a dominant, strong, resilient economy that positions you to be the reserve currency. But there is a feedback and maybe a prior condition, which is that you're the dominant power in the world.
So I basically argue that international currency status flows from that underlying economic strength, that the dollar derived its exorbitant privilege as the world's currency from the fact that the U.S. economy was so large, such a large share of the world economy, and that we were doing well economically and financially. There can be feedback as well. The country that is the issuer of the global currency, the global reserve currency, can basically live beyond its means. It costs us a few cents to print a $100 bill, but foreign central banks and governments have to give us $100 of real stuff in order to acquire one. So a lot depends on what we purchase with those resources. Do we live beyond our means in terms of consumption, of housing services and consumer electronics? Do we use those resources for infrastructure investment and other things that contribute to productivity? So reserve currency status can persist. It can become self-supporting, or the opposite can be true.
And going back to this notion that the reserve currency and its managers see themselves as having a global responsibility, and this is accepted by the political elite. If we look at this post-war period and the Marshall Plan, that is an example of a kind of self-interested altruism and generosity that is really key.
I think it's the best example we have in 20th century U.S. history. The late 1940s and the 1950s were the period of the dollar shortage, when European countries and Japan, desperate for imported machinery and raw materials to get their economies back on their feet, couldn't get the dollars. They had to export in order to get dollars, but they couldn't export unless they could first import that machinery and those raw materials. So the Marshall Plan, I think I'm quoting Winston Churchill now, was the most unselfish act of any major power. The United States did a variety of other things along similar lines, like encouraging European countries to integrate with one another already in the 1950s, even though that implied some discrimination against U.S. exports. We saw it as in our own interest to share the wealth, that it was no fun to play poker if you held all the cards.
And it is during this period, after it reaches its apex, that we see the beginning of America's situation changing as its own policies actually begin to help to create rivals. And it's, say, at this point that we get De Gaulle complaining about the exorbitant privilege, because when there is a turn in what the dominant power can do, it's becoming more costly, there's more pressure on its position, then the fact that you are the reserve currency creates a privilege whereby, I guess, you're extracting rents to help pay for the policies that you're adopting in, say, foreign and strategic policy. Talk a little about that. Yeah.
So that was very much De Gaulle's view, and the French spoke about the invasion of Europe by U.S. Companies, that we were using the fact that they needed dollars as a way to buy up corporate assets in Europe. We were using the fact that they needed dollars as an easy way of financing our budget deficit, and then we could turn around and famously in the 1960s engage in foreign policy adventures in the Vietnam War, something that didn't always go down well with our allies. So the fact that the dollar was far and away dominated in international transactions after World War II, when the U.S. dominated the world economy, made perfect sense. But by the 1960s, the world is gradually beginning to become more multipolar. There's the recovery of Europe. There's the rise of Japan. And there begins to be kind of a tension between the fact that the world is becoming more multipolar and the international financial system is not.
And it's at times like this that presidents are confronted with political problems. And in this case, in the 70s, it's Nixon. And so who does he appoint as his treasurer but a cowboy politician from Texas, John Connally? That's an important kind of turning point, because at a certain point you're not leaving this to the bankers.
Right. I know as a Texan, Harry, you're interested in that particular passage. What I think Nixon was really trying to achieve was an orderly adjustment of the dollar. He wanted to see U.S. exports become more competitive in the early 1970s. As you know, he was well aware that there was a re-election campaign coming in 1972. So getting the Europeans and Japan to revalue their currencies against the dollar would make U.S. exports more competitive and avoid the stigma of the U.S. devaluing. It could be called a U.S. and Japanese revaluation. So Nixon appointed Connally partly because he was aggressive and flamboyant and the ideal person to berate the Europeans and Japanese about the need to revalue. As it happened, others in the administration, like Henry Kissinger, worried that this would backfire and that European politicians in particular would resent being bullied by Connally. I think that's how it turned out. In the end, Nixon got his way. He imposed a 10% tariff on all imports into the United States in mid-August of 1971, when he stopped paying out gold to foreign central banks and governments as kind of a stick with which to force foreign revaluations against the dollar. That worked. The revaluations occurred in December, but it didn't create a favorable setting for international cooperation subsequently. So there wasn't a lot of working together by effective cooperation among central banks and governments in the 1970s. I think the reason was in part the sour taste left from this experience in 1971.
Let's now fast forward to the near present and the meaning of the 2008 financial collapse. I think what you're suggesting and your book is saying is really a crucial element in the use and the ability to possess this economic power is its legitimacy, that it's accepted, that the institutions, the financial institutions that have developed over time of the dominant country, are their legitimacy is accepted. In what way, then, was the 2008 collapse a turning point in causing important parts of the world to doubt the legitimacy of our financial institutions?
So I think we have to be careful here. In the short run, the financial crisis, we saw this already in late 2007 during the subprime phase, but again in late 2008 after Lehman Brothers. In the short run, the crisis was actually good for the dollar. Investors around the world, desperate for liquidity, all scrambled into the most liquid market, which was the U.S. Treasury bond market. So the supreme irony was that the crisis born and bred in the United States was actually good for the dollar in the very short run. But I think more broadly, it led investors, both private and official, to ask whether the U.S. was a reliable steward of its currency, whether it could be relied on to supervise and regulate its financial markets and institutions adequately. And insofar as the answer was maybe, or the answer was even possibly no, foreigners concluded that it would be prudent to hedge their bets, not to put all their eggs in the dollar basket and to begin to diversify. So I think that process of diversifying away from the dollar is slow, it's gradual, it's ongoing, but I think it has been accelerated by the financial crisis and by doubts about the reliability of the United States as steward of its financial markets.
During the crisis, especially in the immediate aftermath, there was a sense, as we examined what had happened, that many of the institutions had failed, all under maybe the umbrella of deregulation. We didn't need watchdogs in place and so on. But on the other hand, there was, one could say, with Bernanke at the head of the Fed, a very effective response that met the needs of the global system. That was a kind of an ongoing tension.
Right. So once again, in the short run, everybody scrambled into dollars. The crisis was good for the dollar, partly because the Fed responded quickly and aggressively to the crisis and provided emergency liquidity when it was needed. It was a good thing that we had a student of economic history at the helm. But more broadly, I think foreign investors, including foreign central banks, are worried not only about the Fed, but they're worried about American politics. They observe that questions of regulation are politicized. They observe that the new Republican majority in the House of Representatives wants to roll back some of the financial reforms adopted last year. And I think they worry about the political situation in the U.S., what it implies for financial regulation here, what it implies for our budgetary politics, and what those things mean for the dollar.
And it's interesting because one of the keys in the earlier period when America consolidated its rise as the hegemon in the global financial system, this meshed with the domestic politics. And I, as you say, we're now having an attack against the Fed. One thinks here of Ron Paul. And what's really interesting is that that line of attack attacks the Fed for its domestic role and seems to be totally oblivious to this international role, because if you did away with the Fed, then you would lose the key institution for doing the work that you're describing in your book.
Absolutely. So I do worry about political attacks on the Fed. As I said before, I worry about how political the debate over financial reform has become. None of that is good for the United States. And insofar as international currency status flows from the underlying strength of our economy and financial markets, none of that is good for the international role of the dollar.
Mm-hmm. Now, as an economic historian, I would like to have you do kind of a physical exam, so to speak, of the American economy. What do you see as the big threats to this reserve currency role coming from within the United States because of the management of its economy? We talked a little about the political dimension, but it also must be the case that we're not managing our domestic economy well. And some of this comes from the response to the crisis, so we have to separate these two things.
Well, it's one of the little jokes people make about the name IMF, International Monetary Fund. Sometimes they say it's mainly fiscal. In the case of the United States, the problem is mainly fiscal. In other words, I think the big worry on the horizon, looking out 3, 4, 5 years and longer, is about the budgetary arithmetic. The one scenario I can imagine in which there was a dollar crash and mass flight by foreign investors, foreign central banks, and private investors away from the dollar would be if we really demonstrated to the world that we couldn't get our budgetary house in order. I think everyone understands in 2011 that our big challenge in the United States is to get the budget and fiscal policy under control. Not today, not this month, but say by the time of the next election at the end of 2012. It all obviously comes back to the politics, and I'm more economist and economic historian than I am political scientist, but it doesn't take a PhD in political science to realize there would have to be political compromise, agreement to address this problem on all of the relevant margins, not only spending cuts, but tax increases as well, to deal with the medium-term healthcare problem in particular, which hasn't been entirely solved, far from it, in order to solve the fiscal problem, bring it under control, and maintain confidence in the dollar.
So what we have is a short-term problem, because we have to do something about unemployment, I guess, and that may require expenditures, but it's really the midterm and long-term problem that we have to address. And I guess we should point out, as you point out in the book, that this is building up over time. So you have the prescription drug Medicare benefits, the two wars, the tax cuts, which sort of add to the deficits. Then we get the response to the international financial collapse. And then we've got this continuing problem with the medical care costs as they're rising. So I guess the issue the issue here is, what do you think it takes to begin to address these problems? Or do you think it's going to take another crisis to mobilize these different constituencies to deal with the common problem?
Well, I certainly hope it won't require another crisis, but I kind of fear on the basis of recent history and on the basis of the tenor of the dominant tone of political rhetoric in the United States at the moment, that it may take another crisis before we, as a nation, come to grips with the fact that the federal government in normal times only raises in taxes 19% of national income, much less than any other advanced economy, and that we're still quite low on the revenue side when we add the states to the federal ledger, that we need to think about how to raise more revenues, and on the expenditure side, we need to think again about the healthcare problem. So I'm not saying anything that readers of the New York Times don't know already, but I fear that the political class hasn't really come to terms with this point. One observation I make in the book is that financial crises almost always come around the time of elections. I don't think it's entirely coincidental that the Lehman Brothers fiasco preceded the 2008 presidential election by a couple of months. Politicians' grip on the levers of power is unsteady. You know, it's not clear whether somebody who's about to be a lame duck can deal with the problem. We have a big election coming at the end of 2012. So I don't think it's too strong to say we have a couple of years to get our act together.
There's an important number. It struck me when I read the book. So we are 19% of our income goes to
federal taxes,
and in the comparable number in Europe is 40%. Is that
well? Depends on the country, but in the 30 to 40 range.
So I guess the other dimension now, going back to the international system, the vulnerability of the U.S., although it still has the inertia of its incumbency. What about our challengers? There is the euro, there is the yuan. I guess what struck me as a lay reader to this book was, well, it's not going to be so easy for either one of them to at least replace the role that we have. They may carve out a different role. Let's talk about the euro first. You've written a lot about the euro. What is the problem there?
Well, the current situation is certainly challenging to those of us who believe that the euro is here to stay and that with time it can become a serious rival to the dollar. But stubborn individual that I am, I continue to believe that that's the case. I think it was Jean Monnet, the father of European integration, who said Europe is forged in crises. It certainly has one now. It has a budgetary crisis, a debt crisis, and a banking crisis. I think a big underappreciated part of the European problem is the weakness of French and German banks. It's from that flows the reluctance of the Europeans to let the Greeks and the Irish and others restructure their debts.
And that's because they've loaned money to their own peripheries, right?
Precisely.
Yeah.
I think when things begin to get dicey again in Europe, Europe will once more be forged in crisis. Leaders will have to decide whether to go forward or go back. And I'm still betting they will go forward in creating e-bonds or euro bonds. I think there will be a permanent emergency rescue facility, and I think there will be stronger surveillance of national policies by the European Commission. So it won't be easy, but I remain of the view that the euro is here to stay, and I think e-bonds will be a step toward creating that more liquid bond market that the euro needs to be to become a full-fledged rival to the dollar.
And for now, though, your one-line statement about the euro in the book is that there isn't enough state, there isn't a Fed, and there is a reluctance of individual nation states to give more of their power to the European identity and
right.
institutions.
And one of the unfortunate consequences of that is whenever a crisis erupts, it gets plopped down into the lap of the European Central Bank. That's the one true transnational entity in Europe. When there has to be emergency action, the ECB can buy bonds, buy Greek bonds or Irish bonds the same day. But there's no European Treasury Secretary to decide on the equivalent of spending TARP money. Leaders have to get together at a series of summits, and bad things can happen while they're engaged in the lengthy process of negotiation. So the other half of that line, of course, was that Europe, the euro is a currency without a state. The Chinese renminbi is a currency with too much state, that China has this panoply of capital controls and restrictive regulations that continue to make it difficult for foreigners to utilize its currency.
And so having too much state, I think, as you just said, and as you say in the book, China is not ready yet to assume this reserve role. And you're really suggesting that to move toward establishing the institutions that could make it possible, that would be a real threat to their developmental model as it's now constituted.
It would require considerable transformation of their developmental model. I think, however, the Chinese are committed to that. They can experiment with the effects. They do so in Hong Kong. They look and see what allowing foreigners to issue bonds in their currency would be by allowing that in Hong Kong and analyzing the consequences. They look at what the effect of letting their companies invoice and settle trade in their own currency would be by letting them do that for the considerable proportion of their trade that goes through Hong Kong. I look back at the history of the United States, which was able to make that transition from a situation where its currency was not used internationally to where it was to a very considerable extent in 10 years. And I think people underestimate how quickly the Chinese are now prepared to move. My guess would be in 2020, there'll be three international currencies. The dollar will be first among equals, but the euro and China's currency will not be far behind, and people will have begun to talk a little bit about the prospects for the Indian rupee and the Brazilian real. Those are two big countries with increasingly large financial markets. They will be the puppies nipping at the other's heels.
And you are suggesting that what we may see is the rise of several regional currencies, which would, you know, coincide with the multipolar strategic world we're viewing. What would that world be like? Would these different currencies dominate in their region, but the U.S. might still hold some diminished global role that would still be important?
So I'm leaving aside the case of dollar crash, where we in the United States fail to put our fiscal house in order and all kinds of bad things follow. In the more benign scenario, yes, I think China's would be the dominant reserve and international currency in Asia. I think the euro would be the dominant currency in greater Europe, where I would include North Africa and Turkey and Russia and various other countries in Europe's neighborhood. The United States is different because it has long been a global power, and we trade extensively with Europe and with Asia, as well as in the Western Hemisphere. So I think the dollar would be different in that it still would be used more broadly, and given our advantageous starting point, it would probably be first among equals.
Let me change the subject a minute, but relate it to your book. I know you have been involved in the award to Berkeley of a major grant to study economic history. Your book seems to be a very good example of what history can bring to the policy table. Because it's very clear in just what the little that we've discussed here that by knowing the history of the rise of the dollar, you can really see clearly and in a better way what's going on and what the challenges are. Talk a little about that and how does one make that an important agenda for students who might be interested in policy and history?
I should say that I'm interested in the history first and foremost as history, because I think the stories are interesting and colorful and revealing. But I'm also interested in what the history can tell us about current policy problems and the longer term prospects. So most discussion of these matters is very, very short term. What did the minutes that the Federal Open Market Committee released the other day imply for whether the dollar will go up or down, and confidence on the part of foreign investors? I do think the longer-term historical perspective helps us understand how, in this case, international currency status is gained and lost in a way that these very short-term presentist arguments do not. If you're interested in the role of institutions, we talked about that before, the role of politics, the role of human agency, the people involved in the policy decisions can be critically important. We learned that from the 2008 financial crisis. Again, history is the place to go to think about that.
Bottom line here, if I can do a summary, it seems to be one thing that we should be looking at, in addition to all the economic factors and the state of the American economy and whether exports will really matter as opposed to infrastructural investment. It seems implicit is the notion that great powers, if they're going to assume this role in the international economy, really have to have both a global perspective and a domestic perspective in terms of institutions and goals. And that one thing we should watch for is how do the rising powers meet this test. Is that fair?
That's fair. You know, I referred earlier to Charles Kindleberger and his view of the 1930s. That is a prominent example of when the rising power could have done more. The Chinese at the moment are aware, I think. I think Chinese leadership is aware that China is playing a growing global role, and it will have to become more involved and engaged in. It will have to exercise more leadership in the Group of 20 and the International Monetary Fund and the other organs of international cooperation. The Chinese approach to date, by and large, has been to attend and sit quietly, or attend and read prepared speeches. And those few occasions when the Chinese offer new ideas, people already sit up and listen very carefully. This was true in 2009 when Governor Zhou of the People's Bank talked about the possibility that the IMF's funny money special drawing rights could become an international currency. And more recently, when he talked about how we're moving toward a multiple reserve currency world, which is my view, the Chinese need to step up. And if you agree with my view that their currency will be a major international currency in 10 years, they will also have to provide policy leadership over the same interval.
Barry, on that note, for the future, I want to thank you for joining us today. Let me show your book again, and I think it's a very clear history that the lay reader, in addition to the academic community, will want to look at to understand the role that policy the role that history can play in informing policy. Thank you very much for the book, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.